Good afternoon, and welcome to the May meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the coast of sunny Maine. And a particularly warm welcome to our public radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord, and I'm the head of the forum. Since 1983, we're celebrating our 30th year this year. The forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of the Foreign Service, journalism, or academia to talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today, the forum is delighted to introduce Ray McGovern. Ray started his career as an Army intelligence officer and then served as a CIA analyst under President Kennedy in the early 1960s. And he continued with the agency through George H.W. Bush's presidency in the early 1990s. During his career at the CIA, he was the chair of the National Intelligence Estimates and was the one-on-one intelligence briefer for President Reagan and his senior NSC staff from 1981 to 85. In January 2003, and that was several months before Bush invaded Iraq, McGovern helped create Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, that's VIPS, to expose the way intelligence was at that time being falsified to justify the upcoming war on Iraq. The organization sent President George W. Bush an urgent memo the day that Secretary of State Powell had misled the UN Security Council on Iraq, denouncing Powell's statements. As you know, it had no effect. He has debated at the Oxford Forum and appeared on the PBS NewsHour, Charlie Rose, CNN, and numerous other TV programs. His website writings are posted initially on consortiumnews.com. Ray is fluent in Russian, German, and Spanish. He holds an MA in Russian from Fordham, a certificate in theological studies from Georgetown. He's also a graduate of Harvard Business School's Advanced Management Program. And his topic today, Obama in lockstep with Israel on Iran, why? Let's give a warm welcome to Ray McGovern.
Thank you, Mac. My good friend Larry Wilkerson has been here speaking to you not too long ago, and so has Stephen Walt, who's a friend, not a very close friend, but whom I know and whose writings I very much admire. So I'm the beneficiary of having the groundwork prepared for me, and I don't have to cover a lot of the basics. So I'm going to lord my presentation today with a bunch of personal observances, personal experiences that may speak better to you than the traditional kind of lecture that you might expect from academe. Just putting my watch here so that I don't go on forever. I happen to be Irish, and it's one of our failings. Now, I mentioned Stephen Walt, and it's probably a good idea to put Stephen in perspective. Many of you know that he and John Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago, about 7 or so years ago, wrote an article that was commissioned by the Atlantic magazine. It was about lobbying, and specifically pro-Israel lobbying in our government. It's called the Israel Lobby. And when the Atlantic magazine got the draft, they said, thanks, but no thanks. We don't want to publish this thing. And so did every other major magazine in this country. They had to go to London, the Review of Books, to get it published. Now, I had heard about it. It did get on the web, at least, that this was going on. And so, as I do far too often, I printed it out and brought it on a plane. I was going to Missouri, where a young woman I didn't know was preparing the kind of tour that I'm just completing now in Maine. I visited every major city in Missouri and a couple in Arkansas as well. It was wonderful. But my first sort of debut was in a town called Springfield, Missouri. And it was a church, and there were It was a very large hall in the church, 300 people, okay? And we were talking about Iraq at the time and how we got into that. But after, in the question and answer session, someone said, have you read Mearsheimer and Walt's essay there? And, you know, I said to myself, thank you for asking that question. I said, yes, I have. I just finished reading it. And I said, what do you think of it? I said, well, this is dynamite. This is something that it's curious. It couldn't be published in this country. But I think they're right on point. But I had just one major problem with it. I said, what's that? I said, well, the thrust of the article was to show how powerful the Israel lobby is in this country. But they left out the most convincing proof of that. Hello? And everyone kind of looked at me and said, I'm referring, of course, to the USS Liberty. Oh, I'll get the same kind of reaction. So I said, well, now, does anyone know about what happened to the USS Liberty on June 8th, 1967? Three hands go up. Okay, three went up in this lecture hall. That's about average where I'm speaking, 1%. And so I picked the fellow in the front. I said, now, sir, why don't you tell us how you learned about the USS Liberty? The fellow gets up. Sir, Sergeant Bryce Lockwood, U.S. Marine Corps, sir, member of the USS Liberty crew. I said, Mr. Lockwood, would you be kind enough to come up and just explain for 5 minutes what happened? And he said, sir, I've not been able to do that. But it's been 40 years. I'd like to try that tonight. Yes, I'll come up. And he came up and he gave the most poignant account of what happened that day in the Mediterranean, where the Israeli Navy and Air Force deliberately tried to sink the USS Liberty and leave no survivors. First, the air attack for the jet bombers, then the torpedo attack from the torpedo craft. And it was only because of the ingenuity of a young seaman from Texas who connected a cable to a sort of a reserve SOS thing that they got one out. And the commander of the 6th Fleet immediately dispatched fighter jets from the USS Saratoga, the USS America, to deal with whoever was attacking his ship, right? Halfway to the ship, the commander, Admiral Geis, commander of the 6th Fleet, gets a call. McNamara, the Secretary of Defense. Admiral Geis, why don't you call those planes back? He says, call the planes back? My ship is under attack. I can't do that. I order you to call those planes back, says McNamara. Guy says, I need to speak to your supervisor. And McNamara's supervisor was right there, and he got right on the phone, and he said, I don't want to cause a lot of trouble with our ally Israel, and so you bring those planes right back. And they did go back. But luckily, the Israelis intercepted the SOS. And they got out of Dodge real quick. What happened? 34 U.S. sailors killed, over 170 badly wounded. The ship limped on its own power back to one of those islands there. I think it was Crete, I think. Or anyhow, and the sailors were taken off to Athens to be ministered to, the ones that were still alive. Now, I mention that because that's illustrative of, well, as I said in Springfield, it showed that the Israelis can get away with murder, literally. And they did. It was covered up not only by LBJ, not only by McNamara, but by the United States Navy. These people who were survivors were told, you mention what happened here, you'll be court-martialed. You are not to tell your wife, and you are not to speak to one another about it. Now, if you want to see some PTSD, folks, you talk to the folks that survived the USS Liberty. I know them. I've been with them. I've had lunch with them. When you can't even discuss what happened with your mates, that's big time. So I mention that because it's a kind of a thing that sort of awoken my awakened my sensitivity to all this. And so I was kind of already kind of worrying why it was that Americans didn't know what was going on in this respect. And then about the same time, there was a hearing. Well, not really a hearing, because John Conyers, who arranged this hearing, was not the chairman of the Judiciary Committee in the House. He was the ranking member, Democrat. So he couldn't get a hearing room. The Republicans wouldn't give him a hearing room. So finally they relented and gave him a little room in the basement of the White House, not the White House, but the Congress, which was about, you know, from where that light is to where this light is, maybe a little bit bigger. CNN, C-SPAN, everybody was in there. We're talking about the Downing Street memos, which showed that the intelligence before Iraq was not mistaken. It was fraud. The famous sentence there says, the intelligence and facts are being fixed around the policy. Okay, now that's July 2002. Report to Tony Blair by his top intelligence official just back from Washington, okay? So please don't let anybody tell you that the intelligence before Iraq was a mistake. It was no mistake. It was out and out fraud. They knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. They knew there were no ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. And that's what we talked about at this hearing. And all the representatives were Democrats, of course, and they filtered in. And it was Joe Wilson, Cindy Sheehan, myself, and John Boniface, who some of you may know from Massachusetts. So after the first hour, when it became crystal clear that it wasn't about weapons of mass destruction, it wasn't about ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, one of the congressmen says, well, hello, would somebody tell me why it was? I mean, like, why we did why we invaded Iraq? And I looked at my companions, and there was no enthusiasm that I could see on there. So I said, well, yeah, I'll take a stab at that. I've been talking at universities for the last several months. I use an acronym, OIL. O for oil, I for Israel, and L for logistics, the permanent military bases we wanted there. Well, I turned back, and I noticed that these representatives sort of froze up when I said Israel. And I said, oh, gosh, this is politically incorrect to mention that Israel has a role in what we're doing in Iraq. And so I said, McGovern, you're not running for anything. You don't need any special contributions. This is your moment. Here's CNN. Here's C-SPAN. And so I said, you appreciate, of course, that the United States and Israel are trying to dominate that part of the world. More freezing up. And you keep referring, I said to these congressmen, to Israel as our ally. And that's really not quite correct. What do you mean? Well, the definition of an ally is a country with whom you have a mutual defense agreement, treaty. And there is none between the United States and Israel. Now, I didn't say this, but I'll tell you guys, we tried to interest Israel in having such a treaty. You know, after the Arabs did attack Israel in 1973, we went to the Israelis and said, look, this is going to happen periodically. Why don't we do a mutual defense treaty? And then, you know, the Arabs are going to think twice before attacking you again. And the Israelis said, oh, isn't that sweet? Now, thank you so much for thinking of that. But thanks, but no thanks. Now, why in the world would a country refuse to enter into a mutual defense treaty with the most powerful country in the world, the United States of America? Well, mutual defense treaties require internationally recognized boundaries. And Israel wasn't going to get any kind of consideration of giving up the West Bank or Gaza in those days. And number two, mutual defense treaties sort of assume that each party, before it goes attacking some other country, will say, oh, hey, by the way, we're going to attack Syria or Lebanon or, you know, Egypt. So just so you know. I mean, things were working just fine for Israel without telling anybody. And they didn't even want this moral obligation to tell people they want to do this. So the Israelis said no. Now, that's fact, and it's not well known. I know it because I know some of the people who were broaching this, and one of them was just mentioned to me earlier on, a good friend, a mutual friend of Max and mine. So I know it's real. The implications here are immense, and the fact that no Americans really know this background, if you want to be, if this is gloomy stuff, so if you want to be a little, try to be a little humorous, some of my friends say, well, you know, they did try to make Israel the 51st state, but that was turned down. You know why? Because then Israel will only have two senators. Okay, I'm going to move on here. I was condemned as anti-Semitic the next day by three of those Democratic representatives from New York. Howard Dean, you know Howard Dean? This is this fellow from around here somewhere? Yeah. Well, he condemned me 2 hours later as being anti-Semitic. And this is kind of an inside story, but sometimes you really get insights from having friends in good places. A good friend of mine was number two in the Democratic Party of Dallas. And she's hosting Howard Dean 2 days later. Big fundraiser that was, his shtick in those days, head of the Democratic National Committee. So she says, Howard, wasn't that great, that Conyers meeting on the Downing Street memos, wasn't that great? Because it surfaced what really, he said, oh, that was awful, that was terrible. She says, what do you mean? It spread a lot of truth around you. He says, no, I mean that anti-Semite guy. She says, you mean Ray McGovern? He says, yeah, that's his name. She says, well, he's a good friend of mine. Oh, I don't care if he's a good friend of yours or not, but I had to go back from a nice little dinner I was having. I had to go back in the office. Abe Foxman and all these people were calling. I had to issue a statement saying he's anti-Semitic. And she says, but he isn't anti-Semitic. Hey, come on. Don't you understand what we have to do in politics? Now, the supreme irony of all this, of course, is that Howard Dean had already been derailed for saying what? Anybody remember? What's that? Well, he said, yeah, well, that came second. The first thing was when he said, I think it'd be a good idea to have a little more balance in our attitude toward the Palestinians and Israel. Oh, you don't do that. And then came the arg, completely unrelated, but man, they took that arg and played with it, and he was arged out of the running, okay? So, this stuff is real, and it prevents discussion of very important problems like Iran. Now, it's kind of hard to know where to start on Iran, but let me tell you that in my profession, which was intelligence analysis, not operations, okay, I always have to tell people, well, here's an example of what happens. I come into the back of a big lecture hall at a university, and this happened about three times already. Two fellows walking in there, and one says, it's him. Yeah. He says, he don't look like a spy. And I never know whether to be crestfallen, or to be happy. But it betrays, it betrays a teaching point here. Everyone, all Americans get their idea what the CIA is about from movies, from the TV, and from the terrible stuff that they read about what the operations department has been guilty of. Torture, kidnapping, black prisons. Illegal eavesdropping? My God. So, let me just make very clear, I'm not from that part of the agency. That part of the agency was an accident of history. It was not intended by President Truman, who drafted the legislation for the CIA, and he said so before he died, okay? It's sort of like something that is available to the president because of one sentence in the National Security Act 1947, which says, the director of Central Intelligence, now is the director of National Intelligence, shall perform such other functions and duties from time to time related to intelligence as the president shall direct. Now, depending on what kind of president you have and what kind of director of Central or National Intelligence you have, that gives the power, that gives the president the power to have his own personal Gestapo, and do not blanch at that word. It is well advised. I spent a lot of time in Germany. I know a lot of German, and when the slogan "enhanced interrogation techniques" came out, it rang a bell. Okay, now I have to add, we don't say enhanced interrogation techniques. What do we say now? EITs. John Brennan, who's now the head of the CIA, and his nomination hearings, nobody said enhanced interrogation. Nobody said, of course, torture. And nobody even says enhanced interrogation techniques. It's all EITs. How about those EITs, you know? Okay. Well, you know what the word comes from? How many of you know German? Okay. Verschärfte Vernehmung. Verschärfte, sharpened, enhanced, Vernehmung, interrogation. It's a direct translation, a literal translation from the Gestapo handbook. And some of those techniques, most of them actually, are to be read right in that Gestapo handbook. So that's an important thing to know. And the only check on that, of course, is what? The juridical check on agency activities is what? Pardon?
Zero.
I can't hear you.
Zero.
Well, in effect, you're right. But juridically, there are supposed to be oversight committees in the Congress reviewing what the CIA is doing, right? Well, after 9/11, well, you can complete the sentence because you've heard it a million times. After 9/11, everything changed, right? And the oversight committees became the overlook committees. And none other than the senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, admitted that in public about 8 months ago. He said, what congressman or senator is going to hold a hearing asking if the administration is doing too much in the war on terrorism? I'll tell you who. Nobody's going to do that. That's why Congress is, quote, AWOL. For those of the younger of you, AWOL means absent without leave, right? He said that. Now, he's not on the Intelligence Committee, but he is on the Senate Armed Services Committee, so that's a big deal. That's Congress's attitude. As long as there's no war on terror, we have carte blanche. Let's move toward the discussion of Iran, because that's what we're talking about here. And I just want to make sure that I set the stage and say that after Iraq, when my colleagues became accomplices in corrupting intelligence to justify a war. I mean, does it get any worse than that, folks? I mean, don't take my word for it. After a five-year study, to which Olympia Snowe signed on, together with Chuck Hagel, okay, it was determined, as G. Rockefeller put it, the pre-war intelligence on Iraq was unsubstantiated, contradicted, or even non-existent, period. What does non-existent intelligence look like, folks? Like forgeries, stuff like that? Well, George Tenet was happy to do it for his buddy George Bush, and that's why they became so close. Now, what happened with respect to Iran? Well, this little spiel about the two CIAs was really occasioned by an admission I have to make, and that is after Iraq, as I watched my former colleagues cooperate in this effort to deceive our elected representatives out of their constitution prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war, you know, I said, wow, you know, not only are they torturing people on the operations side. And incidentally, I had got a great big intelligence commendation medallion after retirement for exceptionally good service or whatever they said. And I returned it when it became clear to me that the director of Central Intelligence, Porter Goss at the time, was going down, beating on Admiral McCain, John McCain's door, saying you have to exempt us from that stringent legislation forbidding torture. You have to give us an exemption. I said, I don't want to be associated, however remotely I was already retired, with an agency like this. And so I gave my medallion back to Peter Hoekstra, the head of the Intelligence Committee in the House. So I was prepared to throw the baby out with the bathwater, okay? Throw out the intelligence part, the analysis part with the operations part. And then guess what happened? You think miracles don't happen? Well, they do. Somebody thought, you know, this is really bad what we did on Iraq. Maybe we ought to get some honest people in running the analysis. And the State Department had acquitted itself very well on the Iraq thing because they refused to buy into this notion that Saddam Hussein was getting a nuclear weapon in a couple of years. And they took a big, big footnote. And, you know, I used to chair not all of these estimates, just a couple of estimates. But the way it goes, you have this big table here, and you're sitting around a table, and you say, you're the chair, you say, okay, NSA, how soon do you think, you guys over there, well, how soon do you think Iran can get a nuclear weapon? Well, in this case, we're back to 2002. Iraq, how could it get? Well, 3 years. FBI, 3 years. CIA, 2 years. Okay, State Department. State Department. State Department representative rises. Sir, you put us in a very difficult position because you're asking us to predict the end of a program that we do not believe has started yet. On a lighter note, it reminds me of my favorite cartoon. It's a BC cartoon, so the pater familias is standing on a big rock, right? And his daughter is a college student, and she's sort of cringing below. And I got this from my daughter, the American history specialist from the University of Virginia. She sent it to me, and here's the pater familias standing on a rock, and he's got this stone tablet, which is obviously a report card, right? So she's cringing, and the caption says, oh, great, history F. You flunked something that didn't even happen yet. Oh, good, good. It's our generation. They can laugh at that. Everybody else will go, well, whatever. Well, you know, that's what the State Department guy was being asked to comment on, to say, predict the end of a program didn't even happen yet. And, of course, he was right. So the good news is somebody said, Tom Finger from State, will you come over and run the estimate on Iran? Iran is the next target in Bush and Cheney's crosshairs. Everyone knew that, at least everyone in Washington. Tom Finger said, no, I can't do that. I said, why not? You're the best guy. He says, oh, well, if you let me bring three specialists from the State Department, people who I know are honest and really, really expert, then I'll do it. They said, okay, you can, and he did it. All throughout 2007, they worked on this estimate on how close Iran might be to developing a nuclear weapon. And in the process, they lucked out and got some really good new information. But at the very outset, Tom Finger said, throw out all those estimates that used to say they're five years away from a nuclear weapon, they're 5 years away. We've been saying that every 5 years since, you know, 1992, okay? So they had a bottom-up assessment. And in November of 2003, the conclusion was Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003 and has not resumed work on it. This by 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, all of them unanimously, as they put it, with high confidence. How many of you knew that? Just to raise your hand if you knew that. Okay. It's not in the New York Times very often. Once a year, you can find it on page 18 in the lower column. But, you know, that's, hello? What happened? Well, we had an honest guy in. He did an honest estimate and found out that they had stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003. How did George Bush react to that? Now, someone was asking me earlier today, how can you make interesting conclusions when you don't have any classified information anymore? Well, I'm going to tell a trade secret here. It's not to leave this room, okay? When I was working as a CIA analyst, 80% of the material I needed to make cogent judgments on the Soviet Union, I worked on Soviet foreign policy, was in open media. Just knew you had to know how to dive into it, and you had to be trained in what we call media analysis, a subdiscipline of political analysis, political science, I guess. So that was then. What about now? Now it's 90%. You know, and you know, I can come down at 7 o'clock in the morning, get on my thing, and at 9 o'clock, I'm at the point where I used to be at the agency, quitting time, 4:30, okay? Because it's also readily available. So this is an important point. You can get cogent judgments from all this kind of thing. So the reason I mention that, of course, is because one of the downsides of this is you have to read books. Now, this is George Bush's memoir, okay? It's called Decision Points, I think, yeah? And I don't suggest you buy it. My friends from Code Pink make a point of putting them in the fiction department of all the bookstores. But, you know, it's not all fiction. He actually wrote part of it. And you know how I know that? Let me read it to you. I'm not going to read the whole thing. No. Okay, here's pages, it's something like 418-19, okay? Here's Bush. Quote, in November 2007, the intelligence community produced a national intelligence estimate on Iran's nuclear program. The NIE opened with an eye-popping declaration, quote, we judge with high confidence that in the fall 2003, Tehran halted its nuclear weapons program, end quote. The NIE's conclusion, this is Bush still, was so stunning that I thought it would immediately leak to the press. So we prepared an unclassified version. New York Times journalist David Sanger rightly put it, quote, the new intelligence estimate relieved the international pressure on Iran. I was furious, and so were the Israelis, furious with the United States over the NIE, the National Intelligence Estimate. And here, I'll just read a little bit more. Quote, the NIE tied my hands on the military side. Now, quote, this is the coup de grace here. After the NIE, how could I possibly explain using the military to destroy the nuclear facilities of a country the intelligence community says has no active nuclear weapons program? Well, bummer. Bummer! Now, if George Bush and the Israelis were genuinely concerned about Iran developing a nuclear weapon and really thought they were, what would have been the appropriate reaction? Are you sure? You know, yay! Hey, you better check that, because that's, or somebody tell the Israelis, you know? Not at all. The juggernaut was going off to war against Iran in 2008. Even Cheney sort of admitted that on a Sunday morning talk show. And it was the intelligence community, not that they wanted to stop a war. That doesn't, you know, we don't want to do this or that. We want to tell the truth, okay? And it was such a boost to my morale that the old ethos of speaking truth to power without fear or favor still existed, and Tom Finger made it happen. Now, I don't know how he kept, I think I do know how, but the real miracle was keeping this from the White House as these conclusions were being developed, and just keeping it very secret until the last thing. So why do I mention all this? Well, I think my time is running out, but I think that people need to take some steps back and realize that it's really quite unusual when the President of the United States, and we're talking Obama now, right before the Super Bowl, not this year, but last year, remember how he said he had this interview with Matt Lauer or somebody like that, and he said, we're going to march in lockstep with Israel. Okay? Now, anybody know, any historians here, anyone know the derivation of lockstep? During Reconstruction, a lot of the blacks in the South were in prison, not terribly different from now, where With 5% of the world's population, we have 25% of the world's prisoners, and most of those are black. Okay, but the idea was you had a chain around here, and you had a ball on this foot, and so you're sloshing around here. You had to pull the, and if you fell or you disrupted the thing, that would be really bad. So marching in lockstep is putting your arm around the shoulder of the guy in front of you and pulling the ball around and going like this. Had to be done very gingerly, okay? Now, that's the metaphor that George Obama used for our relationship with Israel. And the next speech he made before AIPAC, he said, "We've got Israel's back." Okay, we've got Israel's back. Okay. Now, okay, that's sort of a metaphor too, right? So if you're walking in lockstep and you've got Israel's back, who's in front, huh? Who's leading? Sometimes metaphors mean things. Now, we came very close to attacking Iran just after Stephen Walt talked to you in July of last year. A lot of us were screaming in Washington, "Mr. President, what you need to do is say out loud, look, Prime Minister Netanyahu, if you attack Iran, we're not in. You're on your own, okay?" And he wouldn't do it, and he wouldn't do it. And it looked pretty, when Stephen Walt, it looked pretty labile, as they say, you know? It looked pretty dicey what would happen. Well, finally, when Obama was brought to see what this would do to him in the election, that namely he would have to commit to forces, and General Dempsey says, "We don't want any part of a war against Iran." He's, "All right, say it." So Dempsey gets up at a conference in London and he says, "I don't want to be complicit if the Israelis attack Iran." Whoa! August 30th, last year. And I said, "Thank you, God. My God, that's going to do it." And it did. Pressure went off, Netanyahu backed off, the election took place, and McGovern, naive McGovern, says, "Well, now, you know, he faced into it, don't worry about it anymore," and we're right back where we were this time last year. Even though the Israeli intelligence agencies agree with what we say about Iran having stopped working on a nuclear weapon, you still have the politicians saying that there's a grave danger from Iran. Jacques Chirac, who used to be president of France, said it best, I think. He held a press conference with New York Times, Herald Tribune, International Herald Tribune, and Le Monde, and he's holding forth, and one of the questions was, "Monsieur President, do you think that if the Iranians get a rocket with a nuclear, will they shoot it on Israel?" And Chirac says, "Mon Dieu, mon Dieu." "So this rocket, they shoot it 200 meters in the air, and Tehran is in ashes. Donnez-moi un break." I don't know how the French say, "Give me a break," but, you know, give me a break. That was his attitude. Now, that's just the first half of that little incident. What happened 2 days later? "I never said that. I was misquoted." "But President Chirac, you on the TV, and I didn't mean it then, you know." That's how bad it is. And the media is just as bad in the UK, and I can attest to that having spent a lot of January there. So how do I conclude here? Well, I conclude by saying, you know, there's a lot of bad things happening in the world. And among the worst are the 750,000 Palestinians that were driven from their home when I was a kid, as we celebrated the birth of Israel. The two-nation solution is fast disappearing from the possible arena. The Israelis have 600,000 settlers on every hilltop in the West Bank. I've been there. I've seen. A couple of us went up from this fancy road they have going up there, and we saw how the Palestinians were living at the bottom, okay? Squalor. No running water. Where's the running water? It's spraying on the beautiful lawns up on the hilltop. So the fellow who was the mayor of this town, he says, "Well, okay, we we have this land. And one of my friends said, well, how do you justify how the people are living down at the bottom? I said, well, God promised us promised land. I mean, it's very simple. God promised us. And so, you know, I don't know much about the Old Testament, the Hebrew history, but I know one verse. And he says, this verse, he says, yeah, Deuteronomy 15:4, you shall have the promised land. There it is. And I knew a little bit more about Deuteronomy 15:4. And I said, why is it you only quoted half of Deuteronomy 15:4? And he said, what do you mean? So I said, you have a Bible there, open it up. So I said, would you read Deuteronomy? Yes, you shall have the promised land so that there shall be no poor among you. It was a deal, folks. It was a covenant. You shall have a decent place to live so that there should be no poor among you, and that includes Palestinians. And so as I watch all this happen and I see the hope for a Palestinian existence just fading from reality, you know, I'm thinking of what my granddaughter Claire said one time, and I'll finish with this. I was on Lehrer. I used to get on Lehrer. I've been on there three times, but the last time was 7 years ago. So this time, my wife knew I was going to be on the news hour, okay? So she calls Kathleen, my daughter in Oakland. She said, Kathleen, watch Dad. So Kathleen's watching me with her four-year-old Claire. And Claire, after it's over, runs up to Kathleen and she says, Mommy, that was Grandpa. And Kathleen says, well, yeah. She says, well, Mommy, that means the other people are real too. Now that's cute, isn't it? But think of what that means, folks. Think of what that means. If you don't know someone in the picture, the other people aren't real too. And we don't get any pictures of Palestinians to speak of. And we don't get any pictures of Afghans or Iraqis or Somalis or the other people. Oh, we get pictures of the three people killed in Boston, that kind of thing. So I think we have to kind of widen our realm of compassion. We have to, if we're biblical people, as I am, realize that it was a deal, huh? It was a deal. We can have a really nice existence. We can live really well. But if we have what I have, and most of you, I imagine, have a knapsack of white privilege that won't quit, then it's time we took that knapsack off and put some of that privilege into play. And not just stand by our principles or live by our principles, but be willing to use those principles, put them at risk, be able to suffer for those principles so others can have a better life.
Ray, that was great, and I hope at some point in the future, especially if we end up getting involved in something that we start with Iran, I hope you see some of us out there demonstrating. All right, questions. This goes back to the beginning of your talk. Why exactly did Israel attack the USS Liberty?
That's the $64 question. I don't know for sure. There are three hypotheses. We do know it was intentional. We have the intercepted messages, control tower to the plane. Yeah, it's an American ship. Sink it, okay? The thought was that the Israelis had already done their job on Egypt. They were about to go on the Golan Heights, Syria territory. We kind of knew that. As they looked at the USS Liberty, it was an intelligence collection ship. It was 13 nautical miles off the Sinai. And they knew that they couldn't go up and take the Golan Heights because they needed direct communications with the Golan that the Liberty would certainly intercept. And they didn't want the U.S. ambassador knocking on their door and saying, don't go against Syria. You've done enough. That's the best, in my view, the best thesis on that.
Okay, we've got a lot of questions on Iran, but we'll start with I'll try to put a few of them together. How exactly would Iran attacking Iran be in Israel's interest? But a sort of earlier question to that would be, Have there been any updated NIEs since the one in 07? And if so, have they changed any of their opinions then?
Good question. Yes, there have been updated assessments. No, they haven't changed the judgment from 2007 that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003 and has not resumed work. Now, the way it's usually phrased is sort of political. I say, Iran has not yet decided to build a nuclear weapon, you know? Well, plain English would indicate to me if they haven't decided to build a nuclear weapon, then they're not building a nuclear weapon, okay? Now, the first one was...
why would it be in Israel's interest to attack Iran?
Same reason it was in Israel's interest for us to attack Iraq. You destroy a country. Iraq is destroyed. It's not a threat to Israel in any way, shape, or form, for the present. And this is very myopic, I grant you. But when you can destroy a country, and Iran, of course, is seen as an eventual threat of some kind, even though Jacques Chirac is right, one or two. So you get the U.S. to join you into destroying Iran. They don't make any bones about it in their own propaganda.
Okay, we got a couple questions about Syria. What do you think the U.S. Obama administration, what should we be doing with regard to what's going on in Syria? And there's a related question, what do you expect will happen with regard to Syria and the United States, given Israel's actions over the weekend, aggressive military action?
Yeah. Well, this is the real important question right now. I applaud the intelligence community for telling the president and everybody else who will listen that this is a really messy situation here, that we don't know who's who. It's just like Libya. We didn't know who it was that we were defending in Benghazi, Turned out to be some really bad actors, okay? So you have to look a few steps into the future before you get involved in something like that. I think this is why President Obama has made it very clear he doesn't going to put boots on the ground, as they put it. But whether they do a no-fly area, I think that's an act of war as well. My friend Robert Gates said it was an act of war before Libya. It certainly is. And, this is unpredictable consequences par excellence. What was the other part of that? I should probably be taking notes.
Oh, no. It was just what should the U.S. reaction be in terms of what Israel has done to Syria over the weekend?
Good, yeah. Well, I think that, what's the U.S. reaction been so far? Anybody know?
It's been...
Well, the U.S. has said Israel has certainly... justification for being concerned about what's happening on their borders. And we're just asserting that Israel probably, as we always do, probably has it right on its side. But Ban Ki-moon, our guy at the UN, he's already said, let's make sure that nobody attacks anybody else in the area, and both sides need to be a little bit more less aggressive and all that kind of stuff. So right now we're in a holding pattern, and I don't know what the Israelis actually attacked. I do know they attacked a foreign country and that there are other ways to dealing with these problems, and it's really kind of attack first and ask for understanding, if not forgiveness, later. So that's a real tough situation on Syria. I just hope that the people who are pressing for Syria to be obliterated, and I would say that the major mistake at the very beginning was Hillary Clinton getting up and saying Assad has to go. Mm-hmm. That's almost 3 years ago. Where does she get off saying duly elected person, however tough regime's got to go? Well, that set the Egyptian Spring movement on its ear into a movement that, with a little help from the U.S., who says Assad's got to go, we can make him go by violence. And the rest of the story is right there. So I don't know, if she knew what she was doing, but what she has encouraged to happen is what we see happening. More than 70,000 Syrians killed already, and a hodgepodge of al-Qaeda and other people trying to take over the country. And there's no good course of action, but at least we could tell people to restrain themselves. Now, the last thing I'll say, of course, is Syria is allied with Iran. And so if you think that the Iran perspective from the U.S. policymakers is absent from this equation, you think wrong. If they deprive Iran of its major ally, Syria, that's a big deal as far as Iran is concerned. And that's why Iran's not going to let it happen. We don't have the power to do what Hillary Clinton said we're going to do, because the Russians happen to care about this area of the world. Iran's there as well. There are all kinds of other actors that enter the equation. It's not like Iraq.
Okay. I've got a number of different questions on Obama and Iran, and they're kind of good. So I'm not going to try to put them all together. I'm going to read them separately. First one, why is Obama stuck in a Bush-Cheney mindset with respect to Iran? The second one is, which relates to that, that presupposes something. What differences, if any, do you see between Obama and Bush's attitude and stance towards Israel and Iran? And the third one is, who in Congress wants these crazy wars and why? What does Obama get out of all of this?
Really good questions. What's the difference between Bush and Obama on Israel? Not much. Now, on the Iraq War, as I used to say, OIL, right? Oil, Israel, and logistics for military bases. I saw those as like 33 1/3% each, okay, in terms of the motivation. If we go against Iran, if we get involved in a conflict with Iran, it'll be 95% I, okay? I don't think we could ever get oil out of Iran or natural gas. And I don't think we can covet military bases in Iran. So it will be Israeli influence, Israel's wish for us to decimate that country, destroy it like we did Iraq. And that's pure and simple. Now, as far as Obama is concerned, I already showed you what Bush said about Iran not working on a nuclear weapon being a real disappointment for him, a real bummer, right? Okay. Well, guess what? When Obama came in, he said, we're going to talk to Iran. We're going to work out something decent. And what happened was it took, 9 months, but finally on October 1st, 2009, our top representative met with the Iranians together with some Europeans, and we proposed to Iran a scheme that we thought they'd never accept. You give us 2/3 of your low-enriched uranium. We'll ship it out of your country, we'll refine it to the medical standards, about 20% refinement, and we'll give it back to you, okay? Now, guess what the Iranian guy says in Geneva? He says, that sounds all right, yeah. Everybody's shocked. What did they do next? Well, let's meet in Vienna on the 19th of October. Well, we were rejoicing, and it looked like we had a deal going. Guess what happened? On the 18th of October, 5 Iranian Revolutionary Guard generals were killed in a bombing attack on the periphery of Iran, where they're having a meeting. Now, they were killed by a group named Jandallah, which has been supported by Israel, by the U.S., and by the Pakistanis in various parts of their existence. And I don't know where they got this pinpoint information about where these guys were meeting and exactly when, or why they had the incentive to kill them. And, 5 generals killed, but there were 30 or so colonels and the rest of them, okay? How they decided to time it for the day before Iran was going back to Vienna to talk about this deal. Well, I think that was orchestrated in such a way that the Revolutionary Guard head goes to Khamenei, the supreme leader, and says, you're going to talk to these guys? They just killed 5 of my generals. You're going to talk to them? Give me a break. So it became politically impossible. Now, the other story is that less than a year later, in the spring of 2010, Turkey and Brazil went to Ahmadinejad and said, look, you know, let's work out a deal like we almost had. And they worked out a deal. This time, only 50% of the low-enriched uranium would be shipped out of country, out of Iranian control. Now, for those of you who don't know, the way you get high-enriched uranium to make a bomb is by having low-enriched uranium. So if you give away your low-enriched uranium, you ain't going to get a bomb anytime soon, okay? So the Iranians said, yeah, okay, 50%, good. What happens? Hillary Clinton gets up 2 days later and says, we're going to sanctions. This is not the kind of deal we want. We're going to go to sanctions, and we finally got the Chinese and the Russians to agree with us, and the rest of the story you know. So these things have been possible. The Iranians have met us more than halfway, but ain't about Iranians enriching uranium for a bomb. It's about destroying Iran. And I just hope that this president of ours, who I consider a wuss, that's what we call him in the Bronx, who needs a backbone implant, I just hope that he can stand up to these pressures, which are the same pressures that Bush didn't stand up to before Iraq, long enough so that we can have some sensible conversation about what kind of threat Iran poses to us. Thank you very much. You've been very patient.
Thanks, Mac. Thanks so much. Great.